Good afternoon and welcome to our Cato webinar, Let Pharmacists Prescribe. I'm Mark Jaffe, a Cato Institute policy analyst, and I'm joined today by Ross Tsuyuki, chair of the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Alberta, Alex Adams, budget and regulatory chief at the Idaho Office of the Governor and former executive director of the Idaho Board of Pharmacy, as well as Jeff Singer, a Cato Institute senior fellow and a practicing surgeon. After the four of us speak, we'll take your questions, which you can submit from our event page, from Facebook, from YouTube, or from X using the hashtag #CatoHealth. So let's get started. So as a layperson, as the one layperson on the panel today, I mentally put drugs into two buckets: relatively safe over-the-counter medications that anyone can buy, and then more dangerous prescription drugs that you can only take on the advice of your doctor. But this is way too simplistic. The distinction between OTC and prescription drugs is varied by time and place. Sorry about this, just gotta bring up the slides here. Okay, so before 1914 in the United States, there were no prescriptions required for any drug at all. And then in 1914, the Harrison Narcotics Act passed, which required prescription drugs just for a selected number of narcotics. Things stepped up in the late 1930s with the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, but that was not intended to be a prescription requirement. Instead, it just established labeling requirements, which the FDA then used to impose a legal prescription requirement. And those were finally codified into law in 1951 under the Durham-Humphrey Amendments. And this is the current statutory text. And I just wanted to call your attention to the bolded text here: a practitioner licensed by law to administer such drugs. So it doesn't specifically say the word doctor. And so it provides a lot of leeway to allow other prescribers, such as nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. So as I mentioned before, the distinction between prescription drugs and over-the-counter or OTC drugs isn't quite as clear as you might think. My favorite case of this is the GERD or acid reflux drugs. So originally, AstraZeneca released Prilosec as a prescription drug. Then that ran out of patent protection. And instead, they substituted another drug, which was very similar, called Nexium. Studies have shown that they have very similar effects and side effects. But at the same time, AstraZeneca reclassified Prilosec as an OTC drug. So today, you can get an OTC drug or a prescription for GERD or acid reflux that does basically the same thing. Looking at the arthritis drug, this is also a common example where you'll have a drug that has a lower concentration, in this case, 1% of diclofenac for Voltaren, which is the OTC drug, and then 2% for Pennsaid. So if you go outside of the United States, you find a lot of variability as well. A lot of people go to Mexico to get prescription drugs at a lower cost, but in fact, in many cases, they don't actually have to have a prescription. And that's the case with cholesterol lowering drugs, as well as blood sugar medications, and even some pain relief medications that would be available only by prescription in the United States, but are just over the counter in Mexico. Now, Mexico is fairly unique. A few other Latin American and Asian countries also provide a lot more OTC drugs. But then there's also pharmacist prescribing, which we're going to be talking about today. One country that's really taken the lead in this is New Zealand, where starting in 2013, over 1,500 drugs became available with a pharmacist prescription as opposed to a doctor's prescription. Another country that's leading in this area is Canada. And so I'll turn it over now to Ross to fill us in on what's going on there.
Great. Well, thanks very much. Pleasure for me to be here. So as you probably know, really medicine these days is we make decisions based on evidence. That's research evidence. So I'm going to talk about the evidence for pharmacists prescribing, particularly using the example of high blood pressure or hypertension. Next. So before we get into that, you should realize that this area is actually has a lot of studies. The highest level of study is considered to be a randomized controlled trial where people are randomly assigned to either receive the new treatment or a placebo or something like that. This is something that was presented last week, actually, at the European Public Health Conference. So my colleagues have done a systematic review, and there's actually 93 randomized controlled trials of pharmacist care in hypertension. So it's not very often you see 93 trials of anything, but there are 93 randomized controlled trials involving about 32,000 patients. And if you take the average across all of those, you can see that the blood pressure is reduced by about 5.4 over 2.5. So, a reasonable reduction in blood pressure. It's also noted that these interventions had greater effects when they were pharmacist-led. But interestingly, most of these studies don't have the pharmacist prescribing the actual medication. Next slide. So what I'm going to speak about is actually, we call it a full scope of pharmacy practice. It's what pharmacists are trained to do and are meant to do. So that encompasses four areas: injections, and of course you know about immunizations, but also travel medicine and other injectable medications, but also laboratory testing. So ordering lab tests, including point of care testing, which is a finger poke type of test, and prescribing. So that means that's a whole spectrum of activities, but it could be just authorizing a refill of your blood pressure drug or your asthma drug. It can involve adaptation, which is changing a physician's prescription, perhaps because it's the wrong dose, or perhaps because a different format is actually more appropriate for you. What I'm going to talk about is independent prescribing. And so this is where the pharmacist makes the decision. They make the decision to prescribe, they write the prescription, and they take responsibility for that prescription. There's also de-prescribing as well, because as you know, some people are on too many drugs. And then all of this leads to what we call disease management, which includes screening, prevention of diseases, and treatment of chronic or long-term diseases. Next slide. So I'm going to tell you about a study that we did in the province of Alberta in Canada. So I like to talk about high blood pressure because it is one of the most common chronic conditions. And about 50% of the United States has high blood pressure of adults. And blood pressure control is actually not very good. So we set out to see what would happen if pharmacists prescribed in patients with poorly controlled hypertension or high blood pressure. So this was a randomized controlled trial. It was done in community pharmacies, regular community pharmacies in the province of Alberta. And we enrolled 248 patients that had blood pressures that were above the recommended target. So 140 over 90 or 130 over 80 if the patient had diabetes. And these were screened for by their pharmacist. Next slide, please. And so patients were randomly assigned to either have their pharmacist intervene, which meant the pharmacist would assess the patient, look very closely at their blood pressure, and it was actually done on several occasions, calculate their risk of a cardiovascular event. They would do the prescribing as necessary. They would do the lab testing as necessary, patient education and follow-up. Basically, what we did is we gave them the Hypertension Canada guidelines and said, "Here, follow them." Other patients were randomized to control. Now, the control was actually not a placebo. It was not nothing because, remember, all these patients had blood pressure that was elevated. So we had to do something. So what we did is they were given the same educational materials from Hypertension Canada. The pharmacist wrote down the blood pressures on a wallet card and then actually referred them to their physician with those blood pressures. So in both cases, the patient's physician was notified and the blood pressure results were shared. Next slide. So for the results, you can see pharmacist prescribing is the intervention, which is in the blue, and the gray bar is the usual care group. And so you can see this is the reduction in their blood pressure over 6 months. So zero times zero when they enrolled in the study to the end of 6 months. And you could see that the blood pressure reduction was 18.3 millimeters of mercury when the pharmacist did the prescribing. It also dropped in the usual care group, but remember that was those patients were referred to their physician. And so you can see a drop of blood pressure of 18.3 over 8 in terms of absolute reduction in blood pressure. And you were 2.3 times more likely to reach your blood pressure target in favor of the pharmacist prescribing arm of the study. Next slide. So I spoke with some colleagues and they said, you know, high blood pressure is very common. It's not very well managed, and yet it prevents strokes and heart attacks and kidney failure. And so there ought to be an economic argument for doing this. And so what we did is we said, well, there would be some benefits if you were to reduce the blood pressure by 18.3 millimeters. You know, that's going to reduce strokes. It's going to reduce heart attacks, and you're going to get less kidney failure requiring dialysis as well. But there would be also some costs to doing this. You have to pay the you have to train the pharmacist. You have to pay them to take care of patients. That's fair. And we even said that there's probably going to be increased drug costs because the pharmacist would treat the high blood pressure more aggressively. And so we actually made the assumption that it would be about $38 more per month for the drug costs. And then we looked at that from the individual patient level and also at the population level. Next slide. So whenever you're looking at a new thing, the cost can be higher or lower, and the outcomes could be worse or they could be better. And so in the situation where using pharmacists, well, we already know that the blood pressure reduction was 18.3 millimeters. And so on an individual patient basis, if you were to follow somebody over the course of their life for, say, 30 more years, you would save about $10,000 per patient. That's after factoring in the costs of care. Where it became very interesting was if you were to take everybody in the United States who had uncontrolled blood pressure, and let's say just half of them went to see their pharmacist to get care of their blood pressure. If you look at that over the course of 30 years, you would save 30.2 million life years, and the cost savings would be $1.137 trillion over that time period. So again, this is taking into account the costs of having a heart attack and a stroke and kidney failure, but subtracting off the costs that you would have to pay the pharmacists and the cost of increased drug costs. So, but still, the net cost savings is $1.1 trillion. This was published last week, actually, in the Journal of the American Medical Association Network Open. And so this is kind of timely. Not very many things actually save money in healthcare. Next. I'm not going to talk about all the other ones, but we have had the opportunity with prescribing here in Alberta to actually look at other areas as well, type 2 diabetes, urinary tract infections, high cholesterol, reduction in cardiovascular risk in a couple of different ways. And we've got an ongoing one with the treatment of hepatitis C in pharmacies as well. Next slide. So I just want to wrap up by saying thank you for listening to me, and to conclude that there is actually very strong evidence for pharmacist care in hypertension and in other areas. It is what we would call economically dominant. That is, it saves money and improves outcomes. One of the things I haven't talked about is we all have, and this is something we have in common with the United States, is we have problems with access to primary care. And care because your pharmacies are out there in the community already. And when we've looked at it, there's also great support from patients for this as well. So thanks so much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Ross. So now I'm going to turn it over to Alex to learn about experiences in Idaho and beyond.
Thank you, Mark. I'm Alex Adams. From the great state of Idaho, and I'm speaking as the previous executive director of the Idaho Board of Pharmacy, which is the regulatory agency that oversaw pharmacist prescribing in our state. I will say thank you to my colleague, Ross. It's not often that we look at Canada with envy for conservative-leaning policy, but some of the work they did to break down walls to scope of practice is what we were emulating. And what I would first say is pharmacist prescribing, while it seems new, it's actually pretty well long-standing. The first state to allow it was Washington State in 1979. So we have more than 40 years of experience with pharmacist prescribing in the United States, and all 50 states allow it. The thing to look at what level of restriction and how many regulations does it take for a pharmacist to be able to prescribe, because the number of restrictions that a state puts in can certainly impede this in practice. So most folks on this are probably familiar with getting immunizations at pharmacies. It's the first drug product that pharmacists could prescribe, and then after prescribing it, they could administer it to patients. That started in the early 90s. And it kind of had a slow and steady uptake, but what really put it on the scene was the H1N1 pandemic in 2009-2010. There was a need for mass vaccination, and the primary care capacity was generally overrun. So to keep people out of urgent care facilities or whatnot, the federal government partnered and created the Retail Vaccine Initiative for pharmacists to be able to prescribe and administer H1N1 vaccines. That grew pharmacist prescribing from immunizations from about 5% to about 1 in 4 vaccines nationwide, and really showed that the reach of pharmacists and the capability of pharmacists had been underutilized and could bring value to the healthcare team. So a lot of people started looking at, well, what if you combine the accessibility of pharmacies in the U.S.? 95% of all Americans live within 5 miles of a pharmacy, and they're also open nights and weekends. But pharmacists also have medication expertise. They have doctoral level degrees anchored around medication training and how to use the right medication at the right time. What if you combine that access with that expertise? Maybe we can get the outcomes that Ross's evidence speaks to. So in Idaho, we had kind of a long buildup. Our legislature in 2010, 2011 passed bills that allowed pharmacists to prescribe immunizations and fluoride supplements. In 2015, our legislature passed a bill allowing pharmacists to prescribe naloxone, which is an opioid reversal agent. 2016, legislature passed a bill allowing pharmacists to prescribe EpiPens. And then in 2017, the legislature passed a bill allowing pharmacists to prescribe tobacco cessation drugs. Each of those had studies published around them showing that they were safe, effective, that pharmacists could, you know, accurately screen patients for those medications and provide them and monitor them in a way that would mitigate patient harm. But after each of those bills passed, the legislature kind of saw a trend and said, why are we doing this one by one? Why every year is there another drug that is added to the list of what pharmacists can prescribe? We need a better way of doing this. And worked with the legislature and ended up, rather than delineating every drug that pharmacists could prescribe, we put in place a framework that pharmacists could prescribe from. We said pharmacists could prescribe any drug if it met one of the following four planks. Is it preventive in nature? So it's designed to prevent a condition, so no diagnosis is necessary. Second plank was pharmacists could prescribe in Idaho if it was non-diagnostic. So if the patient was previously diagnosed with diabetes, for example, but their dose wasn't optimized and the pharmacist needed to adjust the dose, or they needed to add on an additional therapy to help the patient meet their either blood sugar goal or blood pressure goal, whatever condition is being treated, pharmacists could prescribe. So prevention and non-diagnostic was really trying to avoid diagnosis. There's two areas where pharmacists can and have diagnosed in Idaho. First is for minor ailments. If it's a minor ailment, and the legislation did not define that, but it generally means things like flu, strep throat, urinary tract infections, cold sores, things that are going to generally be self-limiting, pharmacists can diagnose and prescribe for those. And then lastly, the legislation allowed pharmacists to diagnose based off of the result of a CLIA wave test without getting into too much of the wonkiness behind CLIA. It's a fancy way of saying basically a simple test, either a nasal swab or a blood finger, a finger stick blood test. Pharmacists could use those to guide treatment decisions. So we built that framework of what pharmacists could prescribe within those, rather than delineating every drug in statute that pharmacists could prescribe. But the legislature did require the Board of Pharmacy, which I ran, to then fill in the details, which conditions are minor, which conditions are preventative in nature, which conditions can be diagnosed based on a CLIA wave test. And we went through several rounds of rulemaking with each of those, and decided that that was not necessarily the best way to enable pharmacist prescribing. If you look at our colleagues in the medical profession, if you look at our colleagues in the nurse practitioner or physician assistant professions, they don't delineate drug by drug with specific government regulations around each of when you can use them. And in fact, in a state like ours, it takes about 12 months from start to finish to promulgate a new regulation. So if clinical guidelines change or new evidence comes to the market, you're always going to be playing behind the curve, updating those regulations in a manner that just didn't feel necessary. So our legislature actually then went back in and removed that framework of four items that pharmacists, or you know, four planks that pharmacists could prescribe off of, and broaden the authority to be more similar to physicians, nurse practitioners, or physician assistants. And prescribing is now contained within the definition of pharmacy practice, and pharmacists can prescribe according to a standard of care that other similarly trained pharmacists would do in similar practice situations. The benefit is it's relatively open-ended for pharmacists to be able to prescribe within their education, training, and competence, without the heavy hand of government putting its thumb on every scenario. However, because it's anchored around a standard of care, the regulatory board, in this case, the Board of Pharmacy, has the ability to adjudicate disciplinary cases against pharmacists who deviate from the standard of care, causing patient harm. So we have a model of prescribing as that evolved from individual drug classes to a broader framework, to open-ended prescribing in a manner similar to other health professions in Idaho. We would categorize that as independent prescribing. As I previously said, all 50 states allow prescribing in some form or fashion. In most states, it's a model that we call dependent prescribing. It's under a collaborative practice agreement with a physician or other healthcare practitioner, where it's essentially getting a permission slip from them in order to prescribe under the license and supervision of that physician. And that works perhaps in closed door settings where the pharmacist is working side by side with that physician. It has less utility in outpatient settings where there isn't that direct line of supervision, and practitioners may be considered competitors. So we are the first state to have broad, open-ended, independent prescriptive authority. But what we're doing was adopted as model legislation by ALEC. And since that time, the state of Montana has replicated that and adopted that model legislation from ALEC, and the state of Colorado pre-ALEC had adopted language that was pretty similar to what Idaho had. So it's starting to see that diffusion of innovation out there. I'm sure part of the discussion will be what concerns were there expressed prior to this passage, and what has played out since in terms of what the concerns were. I mean, is this going to be safe? Are pharmacists trained to diagnose? And it's Idaho's laws anchored around education, training, and experience of the pharmacist. So it naturally limits what conditions are being treated in pharmacies. I think the most frequent are going to be your minor ailments like flu, strep throat, and urinary tract infections. One of the things we heard quite a bit as well was, what about the conflict of interest? Is there a conflict of interest in someone simultaneously prescribing and dispensing a prescription? And one of the things I'll say about Idaho is we are recognized by the Mercatus Center nationally as the least regulated state. So our limited regulation philosophy generally applies across professions. So just as pharmacists can prescribe, we also allow physicians and any other prescribers to dispense. And in fact, when I was at the Board of Pharmacy, we had more physician drug outlets dispensing drugs to the public than we did retail pharmacies dispensing drugs to the public. So to the extent there is concerns about conflict of interest, it would apply simultaneously to both. We just haven't seen it play out in practice. And that's partly because most patients in Idaho and most other states have health insurance. And when you adjudicate a claim for a medication, it's run against the formulary for those plans. Sometimes there's prior authorizations, and it's also looking for duplicative therapies and things like that. So I do feel like there's a robust system in place to help look at some of those checks and balances. In terms of how it's played out, our broad prescribing has been in place for 5+ years at this point. There's been one study published on it by Ed Timmons and colleagues out of West Virginia University, and it found some beneficial patient health impacts. And then just anecdotally, I'll still hear things today about Idaho's got a lot of resort towns and a lot of tourists who forgot their blood pressure medication from home and didn't have any refills that can be transferred here. So the pharmacist will write a prescription for, you know, a week's worth of blood pressure medications, or a tourist internationally who developed a urinary tract infection while visiting one of our lakes, and we're able to go into the pharmacy and avoid an urgent care or an emergency room visit, and therefore the costs associated with such. So that tells you a little bit about the journey, how we got to where we were, what some of the concerns were in advance, and how it's played out, and look forward to hopefully a robust discussion. And I'll turn it back to Mark.
Thanks, Alex. And then I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to get the physician's perspective on all this.
Thanks, Mark. I've been really enjoying learning from our panel so far. And as a clinician in private practice, I got to tell you, I think this is very exciting because, well, first of all, I think everyone is aware that there's a worsening shortage of primary care practitioners at all levels of clinical practice. We see more doctors retiring early as the population is aging. And so access to primary care has become a real problem. And I see this has the potential of adding a very large number of people to the primary care workforce and really expanding access much more readily. As was mentioned earlier, you know, pharmacies are open on weekends, sometimes 24 hours. I could tell you over the years as in my practice as a surgeon, I've come to respect pharmacists as actually experts on medication. So for example, mostly as a surgeon, most of what I prescribe is either pain medication or antibiotics, but I occasionally prescribe other things. Over the years, I've either consulted the pharmacist because I wanted to prescribe an antibiotic and I wasn't certain if it interacted with one of the medications that I'll see patients who are a bunch of medications from their other doctor or doctors, and I may not be familiar with their interactions because it's not in my specialty. So I'll call a pharmacist and ask, and sometimes the pharmacist would help me figure out what to prescribe. Sometimes the pharmacist would call me and say that I prescribed a medication and it actually interacts with one of these other medications that the patient's on for a different problem. That happens less often these days because almost all of us have now adopted e-prescribing software, which has a lot of built-in mechanisms to try to catch these things, but it's not perfect. And it's still once in a while, you do get that helpful call from the pharmacist. And in the hospital setting, like I said, I'm a surgeon. When we have patients in the intensive care unit who are critically ill surgical patients, and we're making our daily rounds, we usually have a team approach. And a member of the team is usually the hospital pharmacist who is going, you know, bed to bed with us as we're looking at the patient's status and deciding what's the next plan of care, because we rely on that pharmacist to inform the rest of the team about the different, you know, sometimes these people are on multiple medications just to revive them in a critical illness. And they help us in adjusting the medications and maybe adding or subtracting some of the medications they're on. So they're a vital part of the team. So you don't need convincing me that pharmacists are valuable for this. What is most exciting, however, is the fact that if pharmacists are able to, and as Alex mentioned, not every state, but in my state of Arizona, they can't do this. But if you could go into a pharmacy because you are pretty sure you have a strep throat or you're worried that you do, and the pharmacist could perform that test, which is a test, it's a test that the doctor would otherwise perform in the office, and then prescribe the appropriate antibiotic for you if it's positive for strep throat. Think about just the savings in time. You don't have to take hours off work and wait in a waiting room and then get the prescription and then go to the pharmacy, and the convenience. And it's in many cases, because of the shortage of primary care clinicians, people can't get appointments for days, so they wind up going to the emergency room or to the urgent care center, which is a much more expensive way of getting routine sort of minor illness emergency type care, and it's also not a good way to do it because there's no follow-up. So I see tremendous value in this, and I hope it gets more widespread. Now, another area I work in quite a bit at the Cato Institute, people may know, is in the area of harm reduction, treatment of substance use disorder, and the whole the drug overdose crisis that we have. And in Canada and the UK and in Australia, since the 1970s, pharmacists are actually part of the team that treats people with methadone. In this country, they're required to go to these government-run methadone clinics, which sometimes can be miles away or not even, in certain states may not even exist. And they have to queue up every day and take the methadone in front of the clinic staff. And it's very destigmatizing and dehumanizing. But in Canada, the UK, and Australia, it's always been that you can go to a primary care clinician and have that methadone treatment managed in the office like everybody else gets any other condition managed. So it's obviously more accessible and less stigmatizing. But in those cases, and we had a paper come out in September about this, the pharmacist is part of the management team. They usually, in most cases, they don't have to, but they usually get the methadone at the pharmacy. And the pharmacist is part of the addiction management team in communication with the other clinicians on the case, and is usually the one who administers the methadone to the patient. So my reaction to this is I suspect some of my colleagues in the medical profession might worry that this could take away business from them, because a lot of things that people see primary care doctors for are these everyday routine problems, UTIs, strep throat, et cetera. But in the grand scheme of things, I think this is very helpful to improve access to primary care, preventative care, and also reduce cost and increase convenience.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Jeff. So now we'll turn it over to questions, and some great questions have come in so far. Just want to start with one question that we got before the webinar. Multiple states have now allowed pharmacist prescribing of HIV prophylaxis medications. Alex, has pharmacist prescribing of PEP and PrEP become common in Idaho? And then a similar question to Ross about Alberta, but let's start with Alex.
Well, it's allowed in Idaho. So, I mean, it's preventative in nature. So there's nothing that would prevent a pharmacist from prescribing for PEP or PrEP. The demographics of Idaho are such that I don't believe this is a huge service in our state, but we've certainly seen it take off in states with different demographics. Ross?
Ross?
In the situation of Alberta, yes, it's also, it can also be prescribed, but we are also participating in a Canada-wide study that is looking at very specifically PEP and PrEP to have pharmacists prescribe it so that we can get an idea of you know, what the uptake of that is. And so it is being provided outside of the study, but we're also doing it within a study to be able to get some more evidence for it.
Holly had a question.
Can I just add something to
ahead,
that?
Go ahead, Jeff.
The first state in the union to allow pharmacists to prescribe PrEP and PEP was California. Shortly thereafter was followed by, I think, Oregon, Nevada, and then Colorado. Now there are about 17 states in the United States that allow pharmacists to prescribe HIV pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis. There are some limitations. They have to have a collaborative practice agreement with a physician, but I think 10 or 11 don't, Idaho being one of the 10 or 11 that doesn't. But I would, based on that, I wanted to ask Alex, if the people in Idaho, is the general Idaho population aware of the broad scope of practice that pharmacists have so that they know they can go to a pharmacist for pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis?
Well, certainly, thanks for the question. I'll start, I'll make a comment on the first part of your statement and then circle back to the last. There are a number of states that allow HIV, PEP, and PrEP prescribing, as you noted. One of the limitations that I see of the approach of having to go drug by drug or category by category is when each of them are taken up as a separate legislative proposal or separate regulatory proposal before a board of pharmacy, then there's a tendency to overregulate that class. If we're going to prescribe for HIV, PEP, and PrEP, by God, we're going to add a continuing education requirement for it. We're going to require the pharmacist jump over these hoops to be able to do it. We're going to have a statewide protocol that's approved by the Board of Medicine, Board of Nursing, and Board of Pharmacy. And there's this overregulation of it, putting things in law, and then as clinical guidelines change for PEP or PrEP, then that state has to go back in and revise each and every one of those. So it's a really clunky way of doing business, and it's not how prescribing has been done for any other health profession, to the best of my knowledge. So I do think that a model like Idaho's is the much more flexible regulatory framework with appropriate accountability mechanisms built in. The downside is what you just said. When there isn't organized effort around a specific drug class, and there aren't newspaper headlines about pharmacists in this state can now prescribe PEP or PrEP, there's not as much general public awareness of it. And therefore, the service might not have as broad consumer awareness and therefore uptake. So it's finding a balancing act. Often what I see, I go into a lot of the pharmacies here still, and you'll see sandwich boards or big posters saying, if feeling sick, find out quick, get a flu test or strep test here. Pharmacists here, have prescribed for Paxlovid for COVID and things like that. So instead of having a legislative effort drive headlines to drive public awareness, it's fallen to the pharmacies to raise awareness locally. And I would characterize uptake as relatively low. And Ross can speak to Alberta as well. Alberta had open-ended prescribing. And I think I read a study that about 5 years in, even though they had broad, independent, open-ended prescribing, only about 5% of Alberta practitioners were prescribing 5 years in. So for all the concerns about whether or not this will open a floodgate and be potentially unsafe for patients, we've certainly seen, and Ross can speak to Alberta, oftentimes the uptake is slower and has a longer tail than you would think.
Well, pharmacists are very, very cautious. And so we do have now a very high proportion do have their prescriptive authority, and 100% in the hospital as well. But as you were saying, the there's not advertising for this. Part of the study here that's ongoing with PEP and PrEP is a raising that awareness as well. So that's happening now.
Great. So Ross, a couple of questions for you regarding the blood pressure study that you discussed. Holly wanted to know whether patients rated their own quality of life during the course of the study. And another question coming in from another viewer was, did the pharmacist have easy access to the full medical record of each patient?
Yes. Yeah, so to answer the last question first, pharmacists in the province of Alberta have full access to all lab tests and all records, hospital discharge, and that. So yes, we do have that. In terms of quality of life, in that particular study, we did not ask that because we didn't think to ask it. In subsequent studies, we have asked it, and we've actually more asked about patient satisfaction and asked, do you like this in various ways? And the patients love the convenience. We have quotes like, he really explains things to me in a way I can understand. And you know, that dialogue is very important. High level of trust you know, just a very high satisfaction with pharmacist care whenever. And in all subsequent studies, we've been asking specifically what patients think.
Great. Kenneth asks, I think, a question that's on a lot of people's minds in the pharmaceutical industry or the pharmacy prescribing industry. The AMA seems to be actively opposed to this reform. We saw that in Montana specifically. How does a board of pharmacy member or the president of a state pharmacy society approach the AMA to try to get them to move to at least a neutral stance? Maybe Alex, do you want to hazard a guess on that one?
Well, so I'll start at the beginning, which is states regulate the scope of practice of health professionals. It's one of the basic 10th Amendment protections. So all of this falls to the state. Scope of practice is defined by the state legislature. Boards of pharmacy can only pay within the lines of what authorities have been granted by the state legislature. So more often than not, these are state legislative discussions, not state board of pharmacy discussions. What I think is really important, why I appreciate the Cato Institute doing an event like this, I think there's a tendency to look at all scope of practice debates as a turf war, pharmacists versus physicians. And I think groups like Cato or ALEC or in Montana, I think it was their Frontier Institute who led the charge. I think they can repaint these in a different light, that this is for patients. And if you just look at the data that Ross showed, I mean, there's dozens of studies like that outside of hypertension as well. You can increase access to care. You can increase patient outcomes while cutting costs by avoiding ER visits and urgent care visits. And, you know, I don't know that the pharmacy association working with the medical association or the board of pharmacy working with the board of medicine is the right way to think about these. I think it's, are there groups that can accurately describe the benefits that come from this and make that case to the state legislature? In our case, the original bill that opened up pharmacist prescribing passed our House of Representatives 69-0, and it passed our Senate 33-1. So once the evidence was on the table and it wasn't necessarily seen as a turf issue, it was something that was pretty well supported by both parties under both economic grounds as well as access grounds.
Also for you, Alex, Jim wants to know, how many of the benefits of Idaho's scope of practice reform could be obtained in other states via collaborative practice agreements?
So all 50 states allow collaborative practice agreements. So all 50 states allow it, but I don't know that I would unfurl the mission accomplished banner by states just allowing collaborative practice. A collaborative practice agreement means I have to go out and find a physician that's willing to basically give me a permission slip saying I can prescribe for PEP or PrEP or for flu or strep. The power to delegate is the power to undelegate and take away at any point in time. And study after study shows that collaborative practice agreements are relatively hard to obtain in outpatient settings. If you work in a health system, if you work in an ambulatory care clinic, oftentimes the pharmacists there have collaborative practice agreements with the practitioners that they work side by side with. But if you think of your traditional retail outpatient pharmacy, what would be the benefits of a physician teaming up with them on a collaborative practice agreement? There might be benefits for that physician's individual patients, but a pharmacy that's filling hundreds of prescriptions a day is filling prescriptions for dozens of physicians a day. You would have to negotiate dozens of collaborative practice agreements. It's just a paperwork nightmare, which is why it hasn't happened. So I believe Dr. Singer mentioned PEP and PrEP and things like that might not be allowed independently in Arizona today. Conceivably, they could be done under collaborative practice agreement, but practically they're not being done under collaborative practice agreement because of the red tape that's put in its place. So I don't think collaborative practice agreements are a good framework for the future of pharmacy. They got us to this point to help us prove that the evidence is there to justify pharmacists doing these things. But I think we're at a point where it's time to burn some of that red tape and make this as efficient as possible for the benefit of the patients in states, not necessarily just the practitioners.
Terrific, thanks. We had a question that sort of paralleled one of the canned questions that we had before, so let me ask that. Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported increased customer dissatisfaction with CVS and Walgreens. Pharmacy staff seem to be overwhelmed, resulting in long waits and occasional dispensing errors. If these chains cannot handle their existing business smoothly, do you think that they can be expected to take on the responsibility of prescribing? I guess either Alex or Ross, can you weigh in on that?
Ross, do you want to start or me?
Sure, I can start. Well, these are large corporations, and they have staffing problems. And, in my opinion, I think people don't want to work there. And so that's why they have staffing problems. And it's a circular thing. They have staffing problems because they may not staff appropriately to deliver the care. And so, this is a problem. We have corporations as well. The independents seem to do it very well because they're dedicated to it and they staff it appropriately. I think you need to do that. Otherwise, people will leave.
I look at this issue holistically. I mean, we're talking about pharmacy prescribing, but when I was at the Board of Pharmacy, I started, we had 100 pages of regulations. And when I ended, we had 25 pages of regulations, which I think is still 20 too many. But a lot of what we did was breaking down barriers across the entire profession. How do you use support staff? What roles can pharmacy technicians play to defray workload at a pharmacy? We bottleneck too much at the pharmacist. Idaho was the first state to allow pharmacy technicians to administer immunizations. We were the first state in outpatient settings to allow pharmacy technicians to do final product verification. How states define regulations regarding technicians can be determinative of what workload bottlenecks up to the pharmacist. Same deal. Too many states regulate technology too tightly. They prevent offsite services. They prevent technicians or pharmacists working from home, taking some of the data entry and some of the manual tasks away from the pharmacy and freeing up pharmacist time. So I think this is an area where it's chicken or egg. I think too many regulations regarding technology, staffing models, support staff, technician duties have put so much pressure on pharmacists that it is leading to burnout and some of the issues that Ross described. So I think you have to look at this issue holistically. That said, the chains you mentioned and others have successfully implemented prescribing in the state of Idaho. I've walked in stores and seen it myself. So it can be successful. And frankly, the pharmacists I talked to link some of the burnout to not being used to the top of their education, top of their training. If you allow pharmacists to practice the way they were trained, it's mentally stimulating and could reduce some of the burnout issues that are seen out there, is my belief based on the practitioners I've talked to.
Thanks. Question for Jeff. Are you concerned that pharmacist prescribing could lead to increased abuse of addictive pain relief medications?
Actually, it's quite the contrary. Because of the way law enforcement has been tightly surveilling all prescribers of controlled substances based on the belief that the overdose crisis was caused by that. And I've, of course, people who are familiar with my writing know that that's not really what caused it. But as a result of that, many pharmacists are afraid to even fill prescriptions for controlled substances. Doctors, my surgical colleagues will prescribe a post-operative opioid for pain management, and sometimes the pharmacist will refuse to fill it. And the patient will call a doctor saying, my pharmacist won't prescribe it. Everyone is afraid of getting raided by law enforcement. So I don't think that's a problem. I think the problem is in the other direction.
Got it. One audience member expressed a concern about pharmacists not getting paid for this. So that begs the question of, do you think pharmacists will be able and will decide to charge fees for services like prescribing, testing, and treating? And if so, do you think that'll deter customers from using pharmacists as prescribers? Maybe that's a question for Alex.
So we, I'll talk through the lens of what I've seen in Idaho. We've taken a kind of approach where we have not mandated payment, but we have not prevented payment. So to the extent that third-party payers see value in what pharmacists are doing, it was our belief that they would cover the services provided by pharmacists. Some private insurers are covering the clinical service provided by pharmacists on top of the medication that's dispensed by the pharmacist after prescribing. Others, it's a cash business. So some of the pharmacies I've talked to, you go in and there's basically a listing of services and the cost. And in general, the cash price for many of these is less than the copay price for many insurance companies going into an urgent care facility or an ER visit. So, you know, I think there's a market argument that consumers will respond to that incentive and value the convenience of the pharmacy to the extent that the services are proving beneficial. There is one legal impediment federally. Medicare does not recognize pharmacists as providers. Therefore, it does limit the ability of pharmacists to charge Medicare plans for the services that are being provided. There's federal legislation that has been introduced and certainly something that should be looked at by Cato and others as a regulatory reduction opportunity.
Great, thanks. One audience member wants to know about the potential effect of this reform on marginalized communities. He's especially concerned about pharmacists serving communities in pharmacy deserts. Are pharmacy deserts something that we need to worry about? And if so, how could pharmacist prescribing either help or hurt with that issue?
We have a lot of communities. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think we also have a physician desert. I mean, we have a real shortage of primary care MDs, DOs, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. The way I look at it is you're adding one more arrow to the quiver. You're adding an entire new category of healthcare practitioner who can diagnose and treat a lot of routine things. And it can only make things better than they are in areas that have diminished access to healthcare services.
I see. You're muted, Ross.
A lot of, oops. And a,
Sorry. You are. We hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
We have, I would say, more physician deserts than we do pharmacy deserts. And in our small towns up north, they'll have a pharmacy, but they won't have a physician. And so, yes, there is a way to meet that need.
Thanks. Here's a practical question, Alex, from Holly again. How did pharmacists' liability insurance premiums change when the reform came in?
I'm not aware of any substantial changes, so I will disclose I did leave the Board of Pharmacy for a different job within state government, so I can't speak to anything specific with liability insurance that's a left, but at the time of the change and then the first year thereafter, I'm not aware of any change.
Ours did change.
So it hasn't made the news, you know, spikes in pharmacist liability insurance premiums has not made the news and have not gotten on your radar screen. I think we could say that, right?
Correct. And it sounds like Ross has something to add, but I would say the one thing that I do kind of keep an eye on ever since, even after my departure, is complaints that go to the Board of Pharmacy, as well as disciplinary actions that go to the State Board of Pharmacy, and then malpractice cases that are reported from pharmacists in the state. And I certainly haven't seen any change pre and post to suggest that there's been harm or changes in liability, but it sounds like Ross's experience might differ.
I was just going to say that we did have a requirement to increase our malpractice insurance. And we were all required to do it. So that wasn't a huge financial burden,
maybe just to draw out, Ross, that was something that you were required to do as a matter of law to up your liability coverage. It didn't go up because of experience rating from harm.
Yes, that is correct. We had to up our liability coverage. But no, it wasn't because of increased claims.
Thanks. And Ross, maybe I could toss the last hardball to you. A skeptical viewer wanted to know, who is studying any problems with pharmacy prescribing? Medicine is very complex and there are a large number of drugs available and all of the drugs interact with each other, some more than others. Simple problems are easier, but it is not easy to untangle things in more complex patients. So are pharmacists really qualified to handle all these complexities?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the premise is that, and it's the same for medicine, you do not practice outside of your abilities or expertise. And so the cautious pharmacist will refer a complex patient. On the other hand, I would also say that complex patients are often complex because of the many different medications that they're taking, and pharmacists are able to untangle that quite well. So, I think we're in the situation where we actually have evidence that this is beneficial. So, yes, it is being studied. It's being studied systematically and cautiously.
If I could just jump in on this as the clinician.
10 seconds.
Okay. Like I said in my opening, I can't tell you how many times we've sought the advice of pharmacists, either on critical care patients or ambulatory patients, regarding how to handle a medication, and particularly on patients who are on numerous medications. Oftentimes, they're more informed than we doctors are.
Great. Thanks. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to those who joined us today for the webinar. We had a lot of great questions. I apologize we couldn't get to all of them. The video recording of the event will be available on Cato's website soon. And I wish you all a great afternoon. Thank you.